WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Allied forces have been blanketing Iraqi troops in Kuwait with leaflets telling them how they can surrender. And Marines along the Saudi-Kuwaiti border are taking classes on how to accept surrenders. American officials have stated that they will hand out gas masks to Iraqi prisoners of war if there's a chemical weapons attack. And they're stockpiling tons of rice and beans at the border to feed POWs. The treatment of prisoners of war is governed by the 1949 Geneva Conventions. My guest, Alfred Rubin, is a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. We invited him to talk with us today about the treatment of POWs. But first, I wanted to ask him about yesterday's bombing of an Iraqi air raid shelter. The U.S. says it was a military command and control center, and they didn't know civilians would be taking shelter there. Iraq Radio said today that over 200 civilians were killed in the bomb attack. There's been a public outcry around the world condemning these deaths. But Professor Rubin told me that if the United States is right, and the Iraqis were using the bunker both for military purposes and to protect civilians, then Iraq would be in violation of Article 28 of the Geneva Conventions.
The presence of a protected person may not be used to render certain points or areas immune from military operations, and the definition of protected persons really flows to all the civilians on both sides in the conflict. And so it seems to me that any allegation that because there were civilians there, therefore the military installation, if there was one, was immune from attack, is simply wrong as a matter of law. Now, both the United States and Iraq are parties to this convention, as in fact are all the members of the coalition and all the Middle Eastern states and anybody that might think that Iraq is a nice country or that Saddam is a nice person. And therefore that is law that is binding on everybody because everybody's agreed to have it binding. And it seems to me that Iraq is probably abused its position under the convention. I really don't see much question about it.
So assuming that this really was serving the dual usage for civilian bomb shelter and for military posts, and Saddam Hussein is clearly in the wrong here by using his own people to serve as a shield against attacks on his military post.
That's right. That is, nobody in his right mind, no military commander in his right mind, would have agreed to the convention, nor would the United States Senate have agreed to advise and consent to its ratification, had anybody thought that what it meant was that some military group or guerrilla group could hide behind its own women and children and have immune military sites. That is simply not to be believed, and it's weird to me that anybody could even raise the issue.
Now, Iraq also seems to be using archaeological artifacts to protect military equipment. The U.S. military tells us that there are Iraqi MiGs parked by the Sumerian pyramid, you know, because
yes,
the U.S. military is trying to not attack archaeological sites. Does the Geneva Convention say anything about that?
Oh, yes. It's never absolutely forbidden to attack anything that has military advantage. The burden really is on the defending power to separate the military targets from the non-military targets. On the other hand, of course, nobody wants to kill civilians or destroy archaeological sites, particularly in Iraq, where the archaeological sites are a world heritage, not merely an Iraqi heritage. And therefore, Saddam is simply taking advantage of what he regards as the moral sense of the United States and attempting to get a military advantage out of it. He can do that morally, but he can't do it legally. That is, legally, the conventions are really quite clear that the parties should refrain from targeting any of these sites, but to get a military advantage by placing your military assets near them is not a way to protect your military assets. In war, the things do get destroyed, and the conventions take full account of that.
So we have this situation where Saddam Hussein is in the wrong, according to the Geneva Conventions, but right now the hostility, especially in the Arab world, is being directed at the United States for having bombed civilians.
That's right. What you have is a distinction between the law and virtue-based, what's perceived as virtue-based morality in a rather one-sided way. The laws of war are really based on three fundamental pyramids. One is simply that the laws of war that we're talking about here are treaty law, and what Saddam is doing appears to be in violation of his treaty commitments. Very few people know that or are willing to focus on that in time of war, but it does make a difference to us lawyers. Second is the morality side based upon practice of states. This is not virtue-based morality, but so-called positive morality. That is, what is done in time of war? What can you expect to be done? And this rests upon what one could call, I suppose, a natural law notion, that somebody who lies, for example, whether or not it's a violation of law, gets the moral result of lying. That is, he's not trusted, and life is more expensive, nasty, and brutish for a liar. That has within it its own natural law sanction then. And the third pillar is the morality pillar, and that is that there are value judgments involved, and it seems to me that what you really have here are value judgments also, where the question is the life of civilians worth more than the value of the military targets being destroyed? And there, reasonable people can differ. And I understand that the American position is, in fact, that we will refrain from attacking military targets where the risk of civilian damage is greater than the advantage to be gained by the attack. And from that point of view, Saddam has found a moral basis for protecting illegally some of his assets, and he's using the underlying moral virtue-based moral perceptions to do this, which we apparently feel in greater intensity than he does. Now, he's playing, of course, to an Arab audience and to, in general, an audience that doesn't like war, as none of us does. And to those who focus on the morality of it, there's a constant game of second-guessing. Are the military or the military leaders correct in thinking that the value of the military assets targeted is greater than the lives that may be destroyed, the innocent lives that may be destroyed? And Saddam is raising the stakes by placing innocent lives in the way of those targets.
So it appears that Saddam Hussein is using civilians and archaeological artifacts as a shield to protect military operations in violation of international law. We have these conventions, we have these international laws. Saddam Hussein is violating them. Can they be enforced? Can you do anything?
In the main, the answer to your question is bluntly no. That is, the enforcement of the laws of war is normally left to each country that's involved in the conflict to enforce within its own troops. They usually do enforce those, as we enforce the law against Lieutenant Calley during the Vietnam War and others who were war criminals, because it's in our interest to do so. Now, Saddam apparently does not feel it's in his interest to enforce the laws of war with his own people. He thinks he gains enough so that he disregards the interest in enforcing the law, in which case I'm afraid the chances are he'll get away with it, because the law does not reflect eternal justice. God is not sitting on the tribunal, and no tribunal that I can imagine setting up would be effective unless Saddam is captured. If he's captured, it seems to me very unlikely that we could set up a tribunal that would be persuasive to the audience we would have to play to. And the obstacles in the way, then, of enforcing the law through the normal criminal law means are just too great to be ignored. It's perfectly possible at the end of this, I suppose, that we do capture Saddam or some of his leading lieutenants, and we could set up a tribunal. And if we do, I advise that we set it up not as a victor's tribunal like Nuremberg or Tokyo, but rather that we set it up with some Palestinian and other Islamic lawyers, Indonesians, perhaps Pakistanis, lawyers who will understand international law and Islamic law and be able to make it clear to the appropriate audiences that there is no inconsistency between the two and that Saddam has violated both. But the notion that we could set up a victor's tribunal like Nuremberg, or that we could appear to the Islamic audiences as neutral powers enforcing an objective law given by Yoda, is just naive. That we cannot do, and the notion that that we are the law enforcers of the world fools nobody but ourselves.
You're just joining us. I'm speaking with Alfred Rubin. He's a professor of international law at Tufts University. Now, I want to talk with you about what the Geneva Conventions have to say about prisoners of war. First, I want to ask you about some of your own experiences working on behalf of prisoners of war. Now, you helped issue the final protest against Hanoi when the North Vietnamese paraded U.S. POWs in public in the 1960s. Can you describe, refresh our memories, what the North Vietnamese did then with the POWs?
Yeah, I wasn't part of the issuing. I was the lawyer for the Department of Defense, principally concerned in the first level with our Far Eastern involvements in 63, 64, part of 65. And therefore, these things passed over my desk. But the matter was so important that I'm afraid it was taken up by my superiors. But I did know what happened. And that is, the North Vietnamese, when they started capturing American airmen, threatened to try them as war criminals merely for taking part in the conflict which they regarded as an illegal conflict, and our actions as being, that our involvement being illegal and our actions being illegal. They wanted to blame the individual airmen. Well, our response to that was the right to go to war is not a thing that's exercised by airmen. The violations of law that are being alleged involve the question of whether the United States had the right to come to the assistance of the government in South Vietnam, and that's a disputed question, but the airmen aren't responsible for any of those decisions. The airmen would be responsible for violations of the laws of war that they have personally committed. And the U.S. was very clear on this throughout, that we in no way say that no American airmen could possibly have targeted a Red Cross installation or some other protected facility. And we said the question there is one of evidence. Can you show that any individual airman is a war criminal in the sense of the conventions? If you think you have the evidence, we pointed out, the conventions provide for trial by you, but subject to being the trial being observed by a so-called protecting power. And we had lots of countries volunteering to send observers as the protecting power. The North Vietnamese, when they were confronted with this, decided not to carry on any of these mock trials, and they didn't. They also, under a great deal of pressure from the United States and the International Committee of the Red Cross and others, including their allies, including the Russians, changed their treatment of American prisoners of war during the conflict from things that were utterly reprehensible to things that more or less conformed with the requirements of the Geneva Convention. North Vietnam, by the way, was party to the Geneva Convention in its own name. South Vietnam is party in its own name. The United States and just about everybody else there was party in its own name. So there was no doubt about the convention being binding.
So did that experience leave you optimistic about the success that pressures could have in forcing other countries to live up to the Geneva Conventions?
Yes, if the pressures are brought in the way that the conventions provide. After all, Saddam himself has offered early on, about 3 weeks ago, I guess, or 2 weeks ago, to treat American captives the same way that the Israelis treat Palestinians. And in my opinion, the United States and the coalition should have leaped upon this statement immediately and said, absolutely right, and by all means, let's apply the conventions the way the Israelis apply them to civilians, Palestinians, in the so-called occupied territories. And you'll find that the result of that would be treating the captive Americans much better than is required under the Prisoners of War Convention. And if you treat them as merely as prisoners of war, that's perfectly satisfactory, too, because under either convention, you can't put them as protective objects near military sites. And that's all that we really want at this point, humane treatment and keep them away from military targets.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alfred Rubin. He's a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Alfred Rubin is my guest. He's a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Can you summarize for us what the Geneva Conventions have to say about the proper treatment of prisoners of war?
Yeah, first of all, the prisoners of war have to be protected in their dignity, but that's a rule frequently violated, as you could see within a week of the time that the American prisoners of war were paraded before TV in Baghdad. There were pictures in the New York Times and other American newspapers of an Iraqi prisoner of war blindfolded and not being particularly well handled. And these things do happen, and it's, well, they're violations of the laws of war and therefore war crimes. They're the kinds of things that, in fact, happen and nobody takes them terribly seriously. Much more seriously, prisoners of war have got to be segregated from common criminals, kept away from the scene of action if possible. If not possible, then treated the same way that civilians of the detaining country treat their own folks as far as separating them from military targets, and they're obliged to try to separate everybody from military targets. They have to be treated with dignity. They need be, they're required to give as information only their name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. They're forbidden to be tortured. They must be fed at least the same rations as the local civilian population, and possibly with some even better exceptions, for example, if they have religious taboos that prevent them from eating some of the local things that local people eat. There's a whole range of stuff that goes. In the main, prisoners of war are treated pretty much the way any prisoners are treated. It's not a nice life. It's like being put in jail. But they're treated fundamentally humanely under the conventions, and there are certain requirements about notifying the next of kin, Red Cross visitations, male privileges, and things of that sort. None of them make their life very good, and it's a rather difficult situation for them. But that's the way it is, and that's the best that people would negotiate.
Now, it's the Red Cross that's supposed to monitor compliance with the Geneva Conventions, but Iraq isn't letting the Red Cross visit the POW camps.
It need not be the Red Cross. It has to be a protecting power, and I presume that even the Iraqi Red Crescent Society could serve the function of the protecting power. Usually the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is a Swiss organization, does it. But I can understand why the Iraqis might want a particular Red Crescent Society to do it rather than anything with a cross on it, given the propaganda advantages they would gain from exaggerating the what they believe are religious differences. And we see it as all rather hypocritical, since the Saddam's Baath Party is an anti-religious party. But nonetheless, I can see why he would do that. The importance is to get neutral observers in there, and Red Cross people or Red Crescent people who devote their lives to humanitarian endeavors are considered appropriate people for this. Now, if Saddam refuses to permit those kinds of inspections, then he is in violation of his commitments. He's in violation, it seems to me, of his moral commitments, and he's in violation of his natural law commitments as well. And that simply is something that we ought to be playing up in our propaganda as loudly as we possibly can, as we did again in Vietnam. The North Vietnamese initially refused to let the Red Cross run the visits. They did permit Polish delegations, and they permitted some American peace groups like Jane Fonda outfits to visit show prisoners. But eventually the international pressures got too great, and they ultimately did permit some Red Cross visitations, not the whole range, but some. The United States pressured South Vietnam to permit Red Cross visitations against the serious opposition of the South Vietnamese, but we were successful, and the Red Cross visitations did take place. I'm not sure what's going to happen here, because it takes time for these pressures to work, and we all hope that the war will be over before the time has had a chance to make these things work. And in any case, Saddam is playing, as you can see, to a different audience than ours. He's disregarding his word, his commitments to treaties, his legal commitments, and instead emphasizing a moral position which plays to a particular audience that is rather one-sided in its moral evaluations.
So Saddam Hussein is still not letting the Red Crescent, the Arab equivalent of the Red Cross, visit the POW camps?
That I don't know. He may or may not be permitting it. The problem arose during the war between Iraq and Iran, and as I understand it, there were in fact no visitations by anybody who could in any honest way be considered neutral. And the result was extreme frustration in Geneva by the Red Cross people, and ultimately an open press conference called by the head of the International Committee, Alexander A., who actually called a press conference in Geneva and rated both sides soundly up and down for their blatant violations of the convention. That action by the head of the International Committee was, I think, unprecedented or nearly unprecedented, and sent shudders throughout the whole Red Cross establishment, because their whole function is to be neutral. And while Hay's view was that he was being neutral in favor of the law, the reaction was, well, you can't be that legal in this kind of confrontation, because the parties are playing a political game, and you've got to understand that they can't let you in if they think that letting you in is letting in an advocate, even an advocate for humanitarianism. So there was a lot of disquiet about the whole thing. But the result was, in fact, probably some amelioration of the treatment of the prisoners on both sides, some exchanges of at least the sick and wounded, at least those seriously wounded who couldn't in future take part in the conflict. But in the main, the record of both the Iranians and the Iraqis under the convention has been dismal.
Is there anything that you would like to see the coalition forces doing that they're not already doing to protest the behavior of Saddam Hussein during this war?
Oh, I don't think there is very much that they can do technically. I would wish that our public relations effort, our so-called public diplomacy, were louder and more effective. I find that the attempt to control the news as it reaches even the U.S. press has in our country a very negative effect. That is, it makes people simply mistrust whatever the military says rather than believe the sanitized version that the military is presenting. So I think we're probably playing against our own interest by trying to manage the news. For that matter, I wish it hadn't been Ramsey Clark that had been wandering around Baghdad giving reports back. But whoever it is posing himself in opposition to managed news, which gives that person more credibility than I think these civilian observers ought to have. I think that the managed news in this case is probably correct, or more nearly correct, than the unmanaged news, and I think we hurt ourselves by trying to manage it.
Why do you wish it hadn't been Ramsey Clark?
Because Ramsey Clark's position has, rightly or wrongly, been identified with peace at any cost in a number of situations, and he seems to feel that the U.S. is worse than Saddam, which is not a position that plays very well to an American audience, or for that matter to me. I didn't like the war either, and I didn't want it to go into it, but I don't think that we're worse than Saddam. I think we're infinitely better than Saddam, and I don't like to get involved in propaganda games that go on that have this underlying tension to them. I'm not anti-American. I don't think Ramsey Clark is anti-American, but I think he comes across as anti-American because he seems to draw a moral equivalency between ourselves and somebody who, by his actions, the invasion of Kuwait, the razing of Kuwait City, has pretty much revealed himself as not only a war criminal, but pretty much of a beast.
Alfred Rubin, I thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're very welcome.
Alfred Rubin is a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.